Welcome to Say Yes to the Chef. Our guest today is John Clowney. He's the owner of Bull City Cider Works in Durham and Lexington, North Carolina. I'm Janice Escott, a certified cordon bleu chef and instructor.
Hey, my name is Kelly Taylor, and I'm a chef and instructor. How are you?
We're all just great because we have John with us. Yes. Hi, John.
Hey guys, thanks so much for having us out today. It's we really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and talk to everybody about cider and what we are and what the beverage is.
Well, we're going to start right out by asking you exactly that. What is cider?
Yeah, so cider, you know, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, before we were beer people and before this became, you know, craft beer, you know, mega revolution in America, cider was the original beverage. You know, if you look at colonial times, probably 30 to 35 gallons were consumed per person per year, and that was for every man, woman, and child. What we really
How much? Say that again?
30 gallons. 31 gallons a year for every man, woman, and child in colonial America.
So that's a lot.
People were drinking a lot of cider, right?
And making it themselves, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very different from what we see today on the grocery store shelves. I mean, basically, we had a more agrarian economy, more agrarian lifestyle. People had orchards. Mm-hmm. They'd harvest the apples, they'd macerate them, and let it just naturally ferment. So you'd have kind of a barrel-aged, lightly alcoholic cider. And so the kids, they weren't giving full strength. They had what was called ciderkin. But it really is
That's cool.
Kind of a colonial and really America's original beverage that we would drink. You know, I mean, if you looked at water, for example, you could easily die of dysentery. You know, water wasn't good back in the day. However, cider, you know, with the alcoholic content, kind of took care of some of the bacteria, and it was fine for people to drink. So that really was the most popular beverage. When early settlers came over, they really had issues propagating the grains. So by virtue of that, they were able to get apples. They weren't able to grow grains. Mm. So cider is what we had. It wasn't until we had more influence and more immigration coming in from Germany, from Ireland, where you had that influence or influx of those are beer people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Come hell or high water, they're going to figure out how to get their beer. So then you had grain propagation, and people really focused on beer as opposed to cider. Mm-hmm. And I think the other things that really made cider disappear for a long time and people didn't realize anything about cider was the Industrial Revolution. That was certainly part of it. So you had people moving away from agrarian lifestyle, moving away from their orchards, moving into cities. Mm-hmm. By doing that, these orchards went in disrepair. You had this beer revolution from the immigrants that were coming over and propagating grains. Mm-hmm. That also took people away from cider, took them into beer. And then you had Prohibition. And so during Prohibition, a lot of orchards were even cut down. So people weren't making alcohol and weren't making apple wines and apple brandies and things like that. So kind of that was the trifecta that killed cider for the better part of 75 years or so, even longer than that. But I mean, really, if you look at Prohibition, you know, 7,500 years where cider's just been in a malaise. And then really over the last, if you look at the last 15, 20 years, woodchuck's been around for a long time. A lot of people know about woodchuck that's out of Vermont. It's more of a mass market cider. And then that was kind of the only guy in the market until 2012, Angry Orchard, which is Sam Adams. Boston Beer Company.
Oh, yes.
You know, there's no telling how many tens of millions of dollars put behind that campaign, but it really did a lot to open up the cider market and put cider back in front of the population and back in people's minds. So now you see Johnny Appleseed, Smith & Forge, Angry Orchard, Woodchuck, Naked Apple, all these other ciders kind of proliferating the shelves. And so
and very quickly.
Very quickly.
Right,
I mean,
yes.
We're talking about an industry. You know, it's doubled in size from 2012 to 13, from 13 to 14, from 14 to 15. Yeah. You're still up, you know, 75% probably. So there's just huge growth in this market. And we're part of what we would call modern American craft cider. And the difference being we're not doing kind of this, you know, woodchuck or Angry Orchard. And I'm not singling I am singling them out, and I'm not. I mean, a lot of what they've done, they still had that exposure to cider and showing people what it is. But they make their cider very differently from how we make our cider. So if you're looking at an Angry Orchard or a woodchuck, it's going to have a much higher sugar content. Mm. And the way they're doing that is they're going to ferment dry. So they're actually going to start the process the same as us. They're going to pitch the yeast in the raw cider. They're going to start the fermentation process, but they're going to ferment totally dry. So
wait,
what that means...
So it starts by doing what? What's the beginning? You take the apples.
So you take the apples, you press the apples, you get the liquid. And now you could start it one of two ways, right? You could either have the situation where you're going to go with straight cider. So you're literally just pressing the apple, or apple juice. So the difference with the apple juice is somebody who's cutting it with water. You could still get fermentation out of that most likely, but we actually use 100% pressed apple, not cut with water, not adulterated in any way.
Okay.
Once you have your raw cider, what you're going to do is pitch the yeast in. So what that means is we use a dry yeast that's a non-GMO dry yeast. No dextrose or anything used in the kind of drying of the yeast or processing of the yeast, because we want to make sure it's gluten-free. Mm-hmm. So we use all gluten-free, non-GMO yeast.
It's good for you, Kelly.
Yeah, I can drink it. I'm very
Yeah, so, I mean, that is an important consideration. Mm, it is. I mean, yes, as we've kind of seen the trend in the market with, celiac and people who are going paleo diets and ways to kind of cut back on their gluten, that's also helped the cider market a lot, I think, in the last few years. Mm-hmm. Just kind of that awareness of what people can and can't drink or what they're consuming and putting in their bodies. But back to our process, so once you pitch that yeast in, it's going to start fermenting, right? So the yeast is going to consume the sugars, and that's how you're making the alcohol. So what the other guys are going to do, they're going to pitch the yeast in, it's going to ferment totally dry, so it's going to consume all the sugar that's in the liquid. Mm-hmm. Then what they're going to do is add back or back sweeten, so they're going to add back apple juice or apple concentrate to get that level of sweetness back in the liquid. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So our process is pretty different. I mean, it starts the same way. But we're measuring our sugar content from the time we start, and then we're monitoring it every day. And then we're actually cold crashing. So what we're going to do is probably our fermentation now is only taking about 4 or 5 days. But once we hit the sugar level that we want, we're going to cold crash. We're going to take that tank temperature down from fermentation temperature of, say, 70, 75 degrees down to about 30 degrees overnight, 33 degrees.
Mm. So it's
just above freezing.
By doing that, it's going to shock the yeast. Mm-hmm. So in the other guys, some of the macro ciders, they're going to ferment totally dry. Once it's consumed all that sugar, there's nothing left for the yeast to consume. It's going to crash to the bottom of the tank. We're going to shock the yeast, give them this super jolt of cold temperature. It's going to create the same idea. It's going to shock the yeast. They're going to crash to the bottom of the tank. We can then filter out the yeast, and we have the product ready to go. Mm-hmm. The advantage is we're not adding back any of the sugar like we talked about. Mm-hmm. So what we have, kind of the natural sweetness, and obviously the fun part of the show a little bit later, we'll get some cups out and try some cider.
Can't wait.
Exactly. It's always good to have the alcohol guys come to do the podcast, right? As we were talking colonial times, John Adams every day, rumored that's how he started every day was with a tankard of fresh cider. If it's good enough for the president, it's good enough for us, right?
Right.
That should be your slogan or something.
It should be.
It definitely could be.
Absolutely. But that's really, we're leaving some just natural residual sugar in it. I think our style is more of I want to say more traditional in nature. Nobody was using stainless steel brewer's tanks and cold crashing in the 1700s. But the idea of leaving this more natural, unadulterated type beverage is what we do. And I think that is more traditional in nature than what you have on a lot of the mass market ciders that are out right now.
We have to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef. My name is Kelly Taylor, and my co-host is Janice Escott.
Our guest today is John Clowney. He's the owner of Bull City Cider Works in Durham and Lexington, North Carolina. Cider. Wow. What? This is a great conversation about cider.
Well, I'm curious, really, too, to find out how long it's taken you. Like, when did you start, and how long... Because when you have to educate about your product, I feel like that's a whole other undertaking. So I'm just wondering the timeline. Like, how long is it? Because you have another site you're opening. You're obviously doing well. So how did you manage to get from the beginning where people didn't know anything about cider, and particularly a dry cider, you are now?
So, the way we actually formed the company, and I've got three other partners, one of which I've known since we were in seventh grade. We went to middle school and high school together, another one from college, and a fourth partner who grew up.
North Carolina kids.
North Carolina natives, all of us. All of us. We actually have, if you look at our two locations, two of the partners grew up in Durham, and two of the partners grew up 10 minutes north of Lexington. So we're kind of bifurcated, and we've got strongholds now we actually all grew
That's
up.
That's really cool.
But we formed the company, I think I filed all the articles and really formed the company July 2nd, July 3rd of 2013. Mm-hmm. It came out of the genesis of doing the research. I always like craft beer, really like high quality wines, things like that. I was into beverages. And kind of looking at that market, just got this proliferation of breweries, particularly in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. If we were going to try to do something in this craft arena, it was going to be kind of difficult to do beer. And that doesn't mean you couldn't get into beer and be very successful. We continue to see breweries start up and they continue to do well. So the appetite for beer is just gigantic. But there's this unique opportunity and market set for cider in the fact that there aren't 4,200 cideries across the country. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're sitting at about 4,200 breweries across the country. We've got 160 in North Carolina and continuing to grow. That market's somewhat becoming fragmented and saturated, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. and not saturated to the point where any of these places are losing money. They're still doing well, and they're survivable and viable businesses, and people are making great livings off of them. And there's a charm of being the local brewery, the local watering hole where people hang out and part yes. of the community. You know, for us, it's kind of combining that aspect with, you know what, yes, we want to have that community drive and that community-centered kind of focus about our business and be that fun local watering hole. But there's also this unique opportunity set to say, look, we are so early in this game, we could actually become a bigger regional player. Mm-hmm. So we could actually sell our product in South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia, a lot of other places in just North Carolina. So, you know, that's part of the focus for us as well. I mean, we want to grow it into a larger brand that really kind of represents, here's what craft cider is. The same way when you look at some great craft beer brands, like a Sweetwater or something like that, or like a Great Lakes. I mean, you've got so many great breweries that have kind of grown into that platform. They were early in the game. We happen to be very early in the game.
Yeah. Where do you get all your apples?
So when we first started, we got 100% of the apples from Perilow Orchards, and that's up in Moravian Falls. So it's basically Wilkesboro area, Brushy Mountain area. They sell the apples at the farmer's market in Raleigh. We basically found him. He's a sixth-generation family farmer. They've done apples. His family has all their lives. He's got about 100 acres of apples. And we would drive the truck up there. We'd have farm totes, the big plastic IBC totes that are, you know, they hold about 275 gallons. They would press the apples, and then we'd bring them back and put them in the tanks and ferment them. As we kind of expanded and as demand picked up, we had to start looking for larger sources of apples because he does a lot of commercial sales as well. You know, people coming to his market buying apples or apple-related products on his own account, plus the farmers markets and things like that. And he just, while he does cider, it's not his primary business, so he doesn't press as many apples for cider, and he doesn't have as efficient of a press. So then we started, this next supplier we were using was actually Mayer Brothers, and that's probably one of the oldest companies probably in the country continuously operating. I mean, they've been in business since the mid-1860s, I believe, or 1850s.
Wow.
So it's a family orchard up in New York State. It's a gigantic business now, as you would imagine. I mean, they do some supplying of apples to Mott's and I think White House vinegars and things like that. So we've been using those guys for a while. And then most recently, we found this group at CiderCon, and we were talking to them before, Peterson Farms, and that's out of Michigan. And so Peterson Farms, they actually, what we've really liked about them is they are blending the apples in such a way that our sugar content is nearly the same every time, which is very important to us, is controlling yes. sugar content and pH. Those would be two of the primary things that we're looking to control for our starting input. Mm-hmm. Well, they are pasteurizing the cider. They're blending apples such that they're coming up, because we use a blend of apples. We don't use one single apple, and they're probably using a blend of a dozen apples, plus or minus. By doing that, it's kind of a risk mitigation, you know, way to get rid of, if you only use one apple, it's going to taste different all the time.
Yeah.
It'll taste different based on time of year you harvest it. It'll mm-hmm. taste different from a different orchard. It's going to taste different year to year because you had droughts one year and floods the other year. Mm-hmm. So using that blend of apples, if you're trying to sell your product commercially, you kind of need some sort of consistency in saying, okay, when I buy off Maine, it tastes like off Maine every time. So with these guys out of Michigan now, they are giving us the right sugar content every time, the right pH every time. They're measuring that and making sure that's what we're getting delivered. By having those narrow margins, we can make sure nothing's going on with our cider. Now,
it probably makes it a little bit easier, too, for your process.
Makes it a little bit mm-hmm. easier for our process. Mm-hmm. We know exactly what we're getting. We know the lead times for it. We can mm-hmm. very easily, you know, plan how we're doing what we do. Now, that said, we're not turning our back on Perilow and what we do in North Carolina. And actually, as we start up, I mean, we're in transition in Durham right now, getting to our new location, which I know we'll talk about. We are going to use primarily his apples, and we're actually going to do a lot of focus on exactly what I said we're trying not to focus on making off Maine. And that's focusing on saying just a single varietal of apple and doing some reserve series that way. So just using a limber twig, or just using a stamen wine sap, or just using a Kingston or something like that, so that people can see the nuance and difference between what the apples are like. So you can see the type of apple is going to play a big part on it. The pH will play a part on it. And the yeast will have a huge play on the flavor of any kind of product you're making. So, you know, with our Durham location and the production that we'll do there going forward, we'll really focus on bringing his apples in, but for specific purposes, and really do more reserve, higher value add type products with his apples. Mm-hmm. So we're still going to use our North Carolina connection. We love Ty Lowe. He's been a huge part of, you know, helping us get started and really supplying us with everything that we use probably for the first 12 months we were in business, at least the first 8. So
it's almost like a winery, right? So if people want to think of it that way, you know, a lot of times they have a blend to make a wine, and then other times they'll have just a Chardonnay, you know, just one grape.
Yep.
And so you're doing just the one apple. The one thing that I really like that about your products, that you're exploring sort of the flavor of the different apples, because I was going to ask you how you picked the combination of apples that you eventually ended up with, because there are so many apples.
There are so many apples. I want to say.
I mean, there are so many.
I want to say worldwide, it's what, 3,000 or 6,000? I think it might be 6,000 varietals of apple worldwide. And obviously, kind of the genesis of apples, I believe, is out of the Kazakh region, you know, kind of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, that kind of area, is where apples really kind of proliferated from. But we obviously don't grow all those apples in America. I can't tell you exactly how many. We have a lot in America, right? I know we still have a ton, and there's constant research on that and constant kind of pushing the limits. You wouldn't think something as simple as the apple, that there's all this specific research devoted and driven just toward, hey, how do we make a better apple? There is. You know, University of Washington's constantly doing that, and they've got some really cool varietals that'll probably make their way east, I would think, you know, maybe in the next 4 to 5 years where growers here could get a hold of them. But you know, there's all kinds of research, and now we're really seeing, you know, farmers are probably your most conservative group of people you can ever get in terms of, wait a minute, I've got to wait 4 years for that thing to fruit. I don't know about planting apples, because it takes about 4 years for an apple tree to fruit. But you're seeing apple farmers plant more trees and kind of take that risk because they see what's going on in the market. They see this trend towards cider and that this isn't a blip. This isn't Zima, right? This is something
Zima.
or clear Pepsi or something like that. Yeah. It's something they're expecting of, you know what, this is a long-term change and shift in consumer profile.
And probably also that people are traveling other places and tasting other places, just like we did. And you're saying, oh, well, where is it here?
Yeah.
And so they're looking for what they have tasted somewhere else.
Absolutely.
And finally, we're beginning to taste that, so it's really
and we're
good.
Here.
Yeah, and we're here.
It's interesting because the South is really changing a lot, and they're kind of the people who are very traditional and what has always been in the South and what the tastes and the flavors are.
Yeah.
And then there's all these other companies that are trying to kind of blend their experience, their life experience, with the Southern kind of products and the Southern kind of style of doing things. And I really appreciate that you have a product out of apples instead of grains.
Yeah.
Because, grains are hard for me, certainly.
And so, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And not even just gluten-free. There are some problems with grains apart from the celiac.
Well, that's why
you
were saying the
like
paleo
so,
diet people.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So it's
good to
address
that. I think that's definitely
been,
you know, kind of a tailwind to the industry overall. Mm-hmm. I mean, people that have had those consumer changes and preferences, But like I said, I think it's more than that, that people, as they try it, you know, we're seeing beer drinkers who, you know what, they decide they'll substitute and have a cider as well. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I don't feel like beer today, I'll have a cider.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting how the market's changing and accepting that. And I think it's much more accepting of the cider style that we kind of represent and what you guys have tasted and kind of what you communicated about that versus the super sugary sweet style.
Yeah, and let's talk to us a little bit about the alcohol content.
Yeah, so the alcohol content, I mean, we do some that are larger, you know, bigger ciders, if you want to think about them imperial style, where we've done like some bourbon barrel aging. I mean, that gets up to around 10%. We did one that was a high gravity that was around 12% that we released
it's
two Christmases
like a
ago.
Wine,
exactly. So we do some that are bigger, but I would say for the most part,
the average,
pretty much average of what we're doing is 6%. So it's very comparable with a craft beer. If you think about your macro domestic beers, you know, Coors Light, Bud Light, Miller Light, they're going to be running like 4%,
lower,
something like that. Your craft beers are going to be running you know, 5 to 7%. So we're right in the wheelhouse with that. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting, and it looks like Michelob has come up with a light cider I've seen on the market. I haven't tried it. I assume it's just cut with water to a degree. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it tastes like. But I think, you know, there's certainly a market for that where people are kind of watching their calories and everything else, because obviously your alcohol content is going to play on your caloric load as well. But we're running, for our semi-dry cider, it's 157 calories per 12 ounces.
So the cider, the base of the cider are apples, and that's basically what it is. But I noticed on your website, tell everybody your website.
Yes,
so that people can go there.
Absolutely. Please go check it out. It's BullCityCiderWorks.com.
Okay, BullCityCiderWorks.com. And I noticed that that one of the things that you have here are, there are several ciders that have fruits connected to them. And when we come back from our break, I'd like to talk about that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef. My name is Kelly Taylor, and my co-host is Janice Escott. And our guest today is John Clowney of Bull City Cider Works. So you host events.
We do.
So do you want to talk about them? Because they're...
Yeah,
pretty
absolutely.
Cool.
I mean, we try to do a lot of events. I mean, as I kind of hinted at earlier, I mean, a very important part of us is kind of community outreach and using our space, you know, not as, we don't think of ourselves as a bar or just a production facility, but we're part of the community and we're very focused on being a responsible and integral business citizen. And that's in both the communities that we operate right now, both Durham and Lexington. So we try to do a lot of events. We do a lot of things with charities. You know, we work with Seeds, we work with United Way, we work with Playworks, and a host of other, you know, smaller things that people have coming through, charity runs, you know, silent auctions, whatever it is. We try to be everywhere. You know, we try to have our tentacles in the community, and because that's the best way to practice our business. I mean, we live here, we work here, we're part of what this is. It's our responsibility to make sure we're involved. You know, I don't, one thing that we always, that I always talk to about everybody that's at our company is we don't want to be passive, right? We've got to be active, we've got to be out there, we've got to be visible and part of the community. And that's just an operating mantra, right? It's the best way to go about things, in my opinion. But that doesn't mean we're not hosting all these fun events as well, right? So we do focus on having in, you know, all sorts of other things that aren't necessarily charity related. We're actually going to be doing a Pints for Paddles out of the Lexington location in a couple of weeks. So it'll be a kayaking trip.
Oh, that's cool.
It'll be a ton of fun.
Yeah.
So we'll do, you know, I don't know how many slots, I think 20 or 30 slots that we're pre-selling, and we'll go kayaking down the river for a couple of hours. You come back, you can have some cider. I found this guy in Lexington. They call him the barbecue man. He pulls around his trailer and makes the most ridiculous smelling barbecue you've ever tasted. So he's going to smoke a whole hog. That'll be a ton of fun.
Lexington,
yeah.
They know how to barbecue.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's tough to find a guy who they call the barbecue man in Lexington. Yeah. Like, isn't everybody the barbecue man?
Everybody.
Exactly.
So,
which one?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but we do a lot of events like that. And, you know, right now we're at a little bit of a hiatus. I mean, our location where we started and everything, where we're operating in Durham, is where the new police headquarters is going to be. So the city's kind of pushed us out of that space, and unfortunately it's taken so long to get our building permits that our new space in Durham is not yet constructed. I mean, the building's there, but we've got to do tenant upfit and kind of get the bar in and production in. So we probably won't be in the new space in Durham until, at this point, I was just talking to the landlord about 30 minutes before this. I'm thinking we'll be in by the end of August is kind of what we're targeting. We are actually going to be doing a whole series of events. We're pairing up with King Sandwich Shop. So we want to take two great Durham brands, bring them together, and do a lot of really cool stuff in this kind of hiatus period where we're a little bit in limbo, not fully operation in Durham, but we don't want to let the taps go dry. We don't want people to forget about the brand, which I don't think they will because we're still on draft all over the area. But we wanted to make sure we're kind of reaching out and doing the right things for our community. And obviously our 2-year anniversary is coming up in June, so we're not going to bypass the opportunity to have a big party in Durham and in Lexington for that.
Oh, yeah, let us know.
Yep,
and,
absolutely.
So where locally can folks buy the cider?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of, you know, this is an area that is very heavy in bottle shops, and not just Carver, but the Triangle overall. So pretty much most of your bottle shops, your Bottle Revolutions, your Sam's Bottle, Sam's Quick, Beer Durham, Bottle Mix. I mean, basically check your local bottle shop. They're probably going to have growlers of our cider.
Okay.
And then from a draft perspective, well, and then outside of the bottle shops, you know, more traditional formats, Weaver Street Market, all the locations, Southern Season, Whole Foods. We're not really in a lot of the traditional grocery stores at this point because our smallest format has been growlers over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. So the growler is kind of a unique format. Consumer really digs it. It's something fresh. It's something cool. The retailer doesn't really dig it because it takes up a gigantic footprint of their cold space, which is at a premium, right? Mm-hmm. So we're moving into 12-ounce format probably in the next month to 45 days. We should have bottles coming out on the market.
Yeah,
and so once that's out, we should proliferate a lot more shelves around the area. Mm-hmm. From the draft presence, you know, you can check our website or check Facebook. We typically post the links there. Where can you find it?
Okay.
And so we have statewide distribution. So it's not just finding it in this market. Mm-hmm. When you go there, you'll be able to find links and say, okay, where can I find it when I'm going to the beach this summer? I'm going to Asheville in Western North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Where can I find this? Okay. So basically, at this point in North Carolina, if you can get there, you can find our cider there most likely.
And we're going to taste some too. So
Absolutely.
We mentioned before the break that we were going to talk about fruits. What are the other fruits that you use?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, obviously our base is kind of the blend of apples. Like we talked about and how that works. But kind of the cool side of it is cider is a wine. I think you had mentioned a little bit of, you know, it's almost a little more wine-like in nature. Well, it actually is permitted as unfortified wine. So we try to experiment. I mean, it's just fruit fermentation, right? Mm-hmm. Cider's fruit fermentation. Well, that means you can add a lot of other fruits to it. So we've done blueberry cider. We're going to do another blueberry cider. We've done a few different cherry ciders. We've done both the cherry saison plus our cherry tart, which cherry tart actually started as, you know what, we'll think we'll do this as a seasonal toward the end of last August. And it's had such an overwhelming response, we still make cherry tart all the time.
Oh,
and
I
so we actually
cherry
use
tart yet.
Yeah, I'm so cherry tart. So actually, Peterson Farms, who I mentioned where we're getting the apples now, they're one of their primary things and how they really got started in the business back in the, I want to say, 40, maybe in the 40s or 70s when they really got in heavy to cherries, because they're the part of Michigan where basically most of the Montmorency cherries grow in the country. So they spend 2 months out of the year, they actually don't process apples, but they'll have enough cider on hand, we'll still be able to get what we need. But for 2 months straight, all they do is process these Montmorency cherries.
Mm. Oh my.
That's how many that they have up there. So that was really kind of the core of their business and how they got started. So that's been great. The Montmorency cherry, you know, it's going to be what's considered a sour cherry or a wild cherry versus what you're going to go buy at the supermarket that's going to be probably more of a Rainier or something like that for $12 a pound.
I know.
But the sour cherries are the best for baking.
Absolutely. Best for bakings
kind of
and everything
yeah,
like
right,
that, because
exactly.
you're going to have some of the tannic content, kind of this, you know, depth of
depth
flavor
of
to it.
Flavor,
so,
yeah.
you know, that's why we've used that cherry. That's been great. We keep that on year-round. We've done the smash berry, like I had mentioned last year. We basically went to the farmer's market. I bought enough strawberries to fill up the entire back of my truck. I brought them back, and we crushed strawberries for 2 days to get enough liquid in there.
So do you put the liquid from the with the apples when you originally are fermenting it, or is it added in after it's
fermented? We've done
it
both ways. So I would say more of what we've done has been kind of a post-fermentation, so make that off-main base and make sure that's tight and that flavor profile is right. But we've done it both ways. We've done co-fermentations on certain runs that we've done. So like Winter Blues, for example, we did that 2 years ago, and that was a co-ferment with a whole drum of blueberries in the cider. And that was interesting. We fermented that totally dry, so you didn't get a ton of that blueberry pop out of it. And I would say that's the one thing, if you are kind of going either kind of post-fermentation or very near into fermentation, you get a lot more of that flavor profile, whatever that secondary ingredient is. It seems to be the trend with it. If you totally do a co-ferment and you go totally dry, sometimes the flavors and nuance are lost.
Do you think that's because the apple flavor is so strong?
I think it could be.
Yeah.
I think it could be.
I mean, it could easily overpower some other flavors.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And I see that there's some citrus going on here. And
citrus for sure.
Even pumpkin probably in the
So that was so a fantastic cider. So it was Jack and Oak. So we actually did an oak-aged pumpkin cider. So
I see that caramelized.
So you took the, after it was done fermenting, you took it and put it in an oak barrel.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and so that one, we actually use oak chips. And so the advantage of the chips over the barrel is you get greater surface contact faster.
Oh, yes.
So you can actually, as opposed to saying, all right, fine, we're going to leave it in this barrel for 3 months, put the oak chips in, you might leave it in for 3 weeks.
That's a big difference.
Big difference. But when you think about it, you're getting so much more surface contact. So that liquid's touching so much more wood because it's just kind of everywhere.
Clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, very,
well,
very
and that's
clever.
You've seen that, and we're obviously not the people who were the genius ones that came up with let's come up with oak chips, right? Certainly a lot of the bigger breweries and even, you know, some of the distilleries now, Defiant out of Charlotte, they've got some sort of spired system, so they're getting greater surface contact and generating flavor profiles that are more akin to something that's aged for years, mm-hmm. but it's actually aging for months. Mm-hmm. So that's which is a significant advantage when you think, I mean, not just from our perspective, if we're making an oak-aged cider, fine. If we leave it for a year, if we leave it for 3 months, not that big of a deal. But if your whole business is whiskey and you can change, you know, your paradigm of, okay, mm-hmm. this is going to take me 10 years and it actually takes you a year, makes your business viable from a cash flow perspective.
For sure.
A lot faster.
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting idea. It makes me want
to... You guys will have to talk to them.
Yeah. No, they're really interesting. Yeah. I was reading about them. But we'll have to get them
absolutely.
On here, too.
Well, invite me back that day, because hopefully they'll bring samples. And I'll just come. I'll be an intern or a volunteer for the day. I'll get you guys coffee and stand in the back.
We have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef. My name is Kelly Taylor, and my co-host is Janice Escott.
Yeah, well, we have a little ice chest here with the idea that we're going to have a few tastes of this. And
well, better have a few tastes soon.
Yeah. I see here, too, that you that there's one vanilla one, and I remember tasting that. That was absolutely marvelous.
Yeah.
Liked that one.
I liked the ginger.
Lot.
You had
the ginger.
So the ginger, we keep that on full-time in-house, and it's been full-time out in this market for quite some time as well. I don't know that that'll go in the 12-ounce bottles anytime soon. But that is a super clean, fresh profile,
it's
right?
It's delicious.
So
it really is.
If you like sakis and sushis and things like that, I mean, I think that rise up pairs with sushi better than most sakis that I've had, or sojus or whatever.
It's called rise up, R-H-I-Z.
You see,
up.
Now that's the kind of education you have to do, because people wouldn't think, oh, I'll just go get a cider with my sushi. Nobody would think that.
But that fresh just pop of ginger in it where you've already got these influences, and that's kind of pairing toward that plating, it's perfect with it. And it also works with other Asian-inspired foods, I think, really well, whether you're going to use some in your stir-fry or you just want to eat it with your Asian dishes, because you've already got that heavy and pronounced ginger flavor kind of coming through. It's something that marries beautifully with Asian foods, spicier foods. Rise Up's perfect for that. You know, I think of the Sweet Carolina that you were talking about earlier with that honey infusion. To me, that's a great, like, fattier food, grilled meats. You're doing some barbecues. Exactly. Marinating that Sweet Carolina, get your ribs going that way. I mean, that's perfect for that.
So. And I saw here, too, that you have one, to me, it's a summer one, watermelon.
Watermelon.
Cool,
the
that?
Daily Rind, another creative name,
that's
right?
Cool. So, well, somebody's doing well with
that. Yeah, somebody's really having fun with the titles of all these. I
mean, naming is a difficult game because you want to come up with something that kind of speaks to the people and does have that clever humor to it. You can spend hours trying to come up with names, and then sometimes just like, you know what, I don't care. Just name it whatever the ingredient is at this point.
Yeah.
But that was a great one that we came out with last year. We'll do that again this year. Really fun cider. We don't use any of the rind on it. We're just using the meat,
kind of
the heart of the watermelon, if you will. Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was very cool thing for summer.
And I tell you what's really cool with that one as well. I would pair that with, have you guys talked to Crude Bitters? Have they been here before?
Yes.
So Craig's a great guy.
Yes.
I mean, there's so many cool things you can do with bitters that people just aren't aware
with
of.
With cider is delicious.
With cider, totally delicious. The shrubs that he makes. So his cucumber shrub with that daily rind.
Oh.
Beautiful flavor profile.
That would be
good. Fabulous. So good.
Yep. What a great idea.
That's a big thing. I mean, Cider Cocktails, the industry magazine that came out 2 weeks ago, Cider Craft Magazine, the most recent publication, was all about cider with brunch and cider cocktails. So it is, like I said, there is a big trend kind of pushing the limits of saying, look, this isn't just super sugary sweet macro beverage that's a substitute for Bud Light. You know, there is some nuance and some character here. And ways to explore it. So,
well, you're definitely doing that. With what you have to offer so far.
Yeah.
I mean, you are trying to educate people about how to taste it almost and how to drink it with food, which is always really important. And I think it's really an interesting idea to try to help people understand, sort of put it sort of in their. To me, it's more similar to wine than it is beer,
although
I know that a lot of beer drinkers might head that way because you drink it in a glass.
You get a pint of it, right?
Instead of a wine glass, right. You know, so it's like confusing a bit that way because you drink it like you drink a beer. Yeah. In the cup. But it's more similar to a wine.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, ways, yeah. Yes,
it is. It has that depth of flavor and character and profile to it that, you know, definitely, certainly trends toward or lends itself toward being a wine-like beverage.
So. Doesn't have nitrates then. Because, you know, wines, they have naturally occurring nitrates, right? Mm-hmm. Which cause some people grief.
Right.
So that's another benefit.
It absolutely is. Yeah, and on that point, you know, with people, you know, trying the ciders and how we're trying to explore it and obviously having more flavor profiles and kind of pushing the limits with cocktails or bitters or whatever it is, I got to give Matt Beeson and my buddy a big shout out as well. He runs Matty B's Public House, as well as he just started Black Twig Cider House.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I mean, he's just always been, I mean, from the time that we started, just a huge proponent of not only what we do, but the cider market overall. He really gravitates toward it, understands it. He's doing a lot of great things at Black Twig to really, you know, put that in front of people, like you said, let them understand how to taste cider, let them understand the differences between there, because there's so much more difference in it. I mean, you can go so many more directions, like we talked about. You know, you got 6,000-7,000 varietals of apples. Well, you don't have, I don't know how many varieties of grains, maybe you do, but not that many used in beer. Mm-hmm. So there's not as much way to go, not as much runway and flexibility to say, look, let's do this crazy different stuff. So Matt's got probably 60, 90 different ciders over there, you know, and he's got stuff that's going to be more of your French style, Norman style ciders. He's going to have your British style ciders. He's going to have these American ciders, and he's going to have the Spanish ciders. He loves the Basque ciders, those Spanish styles. So kind of that Basque country, you know, they go with a very wild ferment, natural fermentation. So it's really aged in the barrel. And you're going to have all sort of stinky foot. I don't know how it would go with your German stinky cheese, because these are really like out of the box. Yeah, they're already kind of stinky foot ciders, you know.
Right.
But they're interesting. Yeah. You know, there's a whole different flavor profile and whole different time and place for those types of ciders. And I think he's doing a lot for education in this area for it, and really beyond. He's always been active, going to the cider conference and doing a lot of stuff to promote cider.
Well, I think it's a definite different market. You know, like when you have anything that's wild ferment, then it isn't reliable, right? So it's a different, like in America, we expect this sort of standard, you know,
we've McDonald-ized ourselves, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Everything has to be the same all the time.
Absolutely.
Which is just a hard thing to pull off sometimes. Yeah. And it takes away some of the interesting bits of a lot of things. But the wild one, you just get what you get.
You get what you get. Yeah. And, you know, it might be the best thing you've ever made. And if you can isolate it and recreate it, then kudos to you. But if you can't, and you know what? I mean, that's part of the charm of fleeting experience, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you might be at a time and a place and something that you recall forever because of the way it was impacted. I mean, our memory is so driven by olfactory anyway. Mm-hmm. And as you guys know, I mean, you're educators and you're very much into
your smell
into what you do. Mm-hmm. Your smell, which impacts your flavor profile and your memory, is huge. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some of those fleeting wild ferments and just kind of out there might be a memory you always have.
Yeah.
And you can't regain it.
Well, another of the really interesting ones that I see on your website that would be a fantastic pair with something is your cider that has star anise.
Yes. So Orange You a Hippie. That was a new one. I guess we're not too bad on the names, right?
Doing, right?
We got some funny really names.
And on that note,
aren't you a hippie? No.
We have to say,
which is what Janice's daughter calls you.
Yeah, on occasion, I am actually accused.
Accused. Okay. Of being a allegedly.
Hippie. Maybe because I lived in San Francisco for so many years.
There you go.
But she is not a hippie.
On the West Coast. So, and on that note, we want to thank you so much for being here. This has been a very fast hour.
Yeah, I can't believe it's an hour. This
it
was,
is.
It is.
It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I really appreciate you guys having us out here and you know, exposure to what our company is and who we are, and also just to the cider market. So we love doing things like this. And like I said, we try to be very active participants of everything that we do in the community. I hate that we're not, you know, already seamlessly operational in Durham again, but we're coming.
You will be.
And like I said,
and
you know,
can
just,
buy at other places.
They can buy
That's
at other places.
Point.
They can buy at other places.
And
we're still at
soon.
The Carborough Bazaar this past weekend and all sorts of other markets and things that happen around here.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know has a food message appropriate to this show, please contact us at our Facebook page, Yes to the Chef. We'd love to hear from you. And please like us on our Facebook page, Yes to the Chef. And for more information and to listen to all the previous podcasts of this program, be sure to visit our website, www.yestothechef.com. And we're co-hosts, Kelly Taylor, natural chef and instructor, and Janice Escott, Cordon Bleu chef and instructor. Happy cooking, Kelly.
Happy cooking, Janice.
And thank you, John. This has been delightful.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks.